Secular campuses are being transformed, but the students need your help. Last year, students at 41 secular universities asked to start TI chapters. Only 10 could be funded. The rest are still waiting. Please, give a student the yes they've been praying for. They're ready, but they can't share the truth without you. Your gift before September 15th can launch a new TI chapter and change lives. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or use the link in this episode to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I don't know whether you got the title of this talk, but it's Why Becoming More Philosophical is a Good Idea, with remarks on a pair of non-obvious prerequisites to becoming philosophical. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about what philosophy is and why you want to be more philosophical, or why you should, but you do, I think. And then at the end, I'll talk about two prerequisites. And I'll try to keep it moving so we have plenty of time to talk amongst ourselves. So, first, what philosophy is. What I'm going to say is that philosophy is the use of unaided reason or natural reason to ask and answer fundamental questions, okay? So it's unaided reason or, same thing, natural reason, and then asking and answering fundamental questions. So let me just talk about those two pieces. Unaided reason, I just mean reason not that doesn't have recourse to revelation. Now, it may be that you get some of your best ideas from the Bible or whatever. Okay, that's not a problem as far as natural reason goes, actually. But when we talk about doing things by unaided reason, that means that we don't appeal to revelation for the proof of what we say or for the evidence for what we say. So even if you found something in the Bible, if you could then give a non-revealed argumentation for it, then you would be proceeding by natural reason or unaided reason, right, without the aid of revelation. Now you might say, why would you do that, right? Like, if it's raining and it's hot and you could drive, why would you walk? So in the same way, like if you have revelation, like why not use it? And that's not a stupid question. But among other, so I'll just say two things really briefly about this. One is that God gave us reason. So maybe he actually does want to see us use it. That's a complicated question, but I do think that's a relevant part of the answer. But the other thing is this. The fact is you can't do everything on the basis of revelation. And the reason you can't is because not everything that you might want to know is in revelation. And the easiest way to see this, I think, is just to ask yourself, what if you knew nothing? Like literally you knew nothing. And then you open the Bible. Well, you couldn't read it. Because you know nothing, right? The Bible doesn't teach you how to read English or Greek or Hebrew. So you have to already know a language to read the Bible. And then if you read the stories, you'd be like, so what is this thing here? So like, it says that Jesus is in a boat and they're like fishing, but like, what are fish? What's a boat? I don't get it, right? So you have to already know. And the Bible doesn't tell you what boats are, right? That's not, yeah, or what fish are. Or if you didn't know, here, let me say something a little bit more philosophical sounding. Think of the story of Joseph and his brothers, right? Joseph gets kidnapped. He gets carted away to Egypt. Then later he meets his brothers. You can't follow that story unless you already have a notion of a person and how persons can exist as the same person through time and space. And then you can fail to recognize persons and then later recognize. All of that stuff, you have to already know that in order to follow the story. So it turns out you just have to bring a lot of stuff with you to the Bible. Is that dangerous? Yeah. Why? Because what if your philosophy is all screwy, that it might lead you to misunderstand the Bible. That's absolutely true, but there's no alternative, because the alternative is that you can't read the Bible at all. But that gives you a motivation to not just bring some philosophy to the Bible, but to bring good philosophy to the Bible. That's why we might want to do it. Okay, but so there's so much for unaided reason and why we might want to have it or use it. The second is the second point I want to talk about is asking and answering fundamental questions. So to explain what I mean by fundamentality, let me just give an example. Suppose you are learning English. It's not your first language. And you want to say that someone got up on top of a rock by doing this jumping business. But you want to say it in the past, and you don't know, should I say he jumped onto the rock, or should I say he jamp onto the rock? I mean, if you know English, it sounds silly, but like it's not silly, right? Because you don't say swimmed, you say swam. So why not jamp? It seems like a perfectly good word. It isn't, but it could be, you know? So you would ask, is it jump, jumped, or jamp? And then someone would tell you. So they ask, you asked a question, a good question, and you got an answer. It's a good question, but it's not a very fundamental question. At some point you might say, hold on now, how come sometimes you add ed and other times you change the vowel? What's that all about? And then the person would give you an explanation in terms of two types of verb in English, strong verbs and weak verbs. Okay. Then later you might say, what are verbs? I think in school they told me that verbs are action words, but like is a verb, right? And is not really an action. It seems weird to call it an action. It's like, what are verbs? And then later you might ask, how come some sounds are words and other sounds are not words? If I just go flurig, that's not a word. I mean, it sounds like it might be a word in, you know, I don't know, Viking or something. But like, it's not. I hope it's not. Because then otherwise it's not a good example. So anyway, as you keep, you know, if we were having a conversation and over the course of 3 hours, we went from, is it jump or jamp, to why are these verbs different, to what is a verb, to what are words, at some point somebody might go, whoa, it's getting kind of philosophical. And they'd be right, because philosophical questions just are fundamental questions. As they get more and more basic, they get more and more down to the roots or the foundations of things. That's more what we mean by a philosophical question. And if it turns out that there's a kind of gray area where a question is getting pretty philosophical, but you're not exactly sure whether it's like strictly speaking officially a philosophy question, that doesn't matter. It's philosophical. I don't think there needs to be a sharp line. So if you're doing history, you'll be looking at evidence. And you'll start to wonder, like, how do you even know if, you know, you have like a document or something and it's evidence, but it's not always clear what it's evidence of, right? Like if the document says, you know, written in World War II that so-and-so did this, that might be evidence that he did it, or it might just be evidence that the person who wrote it wanted someone to believe that, right? It might have been a forgery or some kind of psyops operation or something like that. So you have evidence, but you're not sure what it's evidence for, and it makes you wonder how you tell. And that might make you wonder, like, what is evidence in the first place? Well, at a certain point, your work as a historian has led you to ask questions that you might say belong to the philosophy of history, or even to just philosophy. Or again, like in the philosophy of science, you know, there's this weird thing that I don't understand where, like, electrons go somewhere and then they come back out and you can't tell which electron is which. I have no idea what that's supposed to be. But it raises questions about whether, like, can one thing be two things and two things be one thing? I mean, I want to say no, but presumably those physicists are saying something, right? So physics has raised these really deep questions. Are they physics questions? Are they philosophy questions? Well, they're pretty philosophical anyway. Okay, so this is just an example of what I'm just trying to get at the idea of what we mean when we talk about doing philosophy, asking and answering fundamental questions on the basis of reason alone, as we say. Okay? Now, why is it important? Why would you want to do this? The first answer is fine as far as it goes. It just doesn't go super far. The first answer would be just this. Well, you learn true things. Isn't that good enough for you? You don't want to know true things? But the thing is, the reason that's not such a great answer is because there's any number of true things, right? Like,
well, I know.
They used to, I guess they don't anymore, but they used to have these things called phone books. And you could just, if you wanted, you could just pop open the phone book and look up a random person's name and their number. Now you learned something true, but like, so what? Right? Or I could just go online and get the train schedule for, you know, a certain part of Austria. But like, I'm here in DC, why would I do this? You know, it seems kind of pointless. So just because you're learning truths doesn't seem enough. Even though people sometimes try to bully you with this idea, right? You should desire knowledge for its own sake, but surely not just any knowledge of just anything. Well, of course, philosophy is knowledge of fundamental truths, not just any old truths. So let's zero in on that. What's good about learning about fundamental truths? And the answer, I think, is that precisely because fundamental truths are fundamental, they are exerting their influence all the time. They're exerting their influence on your thinking and on other people's thinking. So when you're dealing with people in school, in your job, or whatever, they are proceeding on the basis of deeper presuppositions, deeper than the things that they are saying. They're saying certain things, but there are deeper assumptions underlying what they're saying. They may or may not be aware of it themselves. If you aren't in the habit of thinking philosophically, then there's a decent chance that you will miss the deeper assumptions of what's going on. And what that means is other people will be running the show. You won't be in control of the conversation. You won't see what's really going forward. You'll be kind of getting outplayed. And it's the same thing with your own thoughts, because you yourself, I mean, there's nothing personal. It's true of everybody, including me, right? There are always deeper presuppositions to the things that we think and the things that we say. And if we don't know what they are, then we're just proceeding basically on the basis of somebody else's philosophy. And for all I know, I'm sort of carrying water for other people whose views I would definitely not want to be carrying water for if only I realized this. So when you get into the habit of asking and trying to answer these more fundamental questions, it increases the chances that you'll be actually able to know what's going on in any conversation that you're in, or any deliberation, any attempt to form a shared judgment, or when you're reading the newspaper, or whatever. So these fundamental ideas are always operative. How does that expression go? You know, you might not be interested in them, but they're interested in you. That's the idea here. Okay. Now, because fundamental truths, or if you know what I mean, falsehoods in the sense of incorrect but deep claims, because they're so fundamental, they serve an organizing function and a judging function. What I mean by organizing is they set the sort of general categories and structures in which other ideas and thoughts fall into place. And what I mean by judging is that based on your fundamental ideas that you have going, you will perceive some things as like true and worth taking seriously and others as just stupid. And you'll just dismiss them based on these fundamental presuppositions. So I'm going to make two points now about this. One is that that's just a way of spelling out why these fundamental things are so important, right? Because they're organizing our thinking, and because they are, in a sense, judging or filtering things, letting things in and keeping them out. The second point I want to add to this, though, is that, let me, Aristotle says in early on in the Metaphysics, he's actually talking about metaphysics. But this applies to all of philosophy. He says, the wise man knows all things, but not in detail. That little last thing there, but not in detail, is incredibly important. Okay, so when you are in possession of a lot of fundamental principles, there's a sense in which, you know what's going on in a wide range of circumstances. And so no matter what anybody's talking about, you can kind of listen in, figure out what's going on, and then say some things. On the other hand, you don't know in detail. You may think, well, look, I'm a philosopher. I know a lot about biology. But that doesn't actually mean you know how protein folding works, okay? It just doesn't mean that. And I don't know whether you've had the opportunity to observe this, or perhaps to be victimized by it, or a victimizer. But this is like the classic philosophy major at the party kind of thing. You know what I'm talking about, right? So like people are talking and then somebody goes, hold on. What you really mean is this, right? And everybody else wants to punch him. Okay. Except the other philosophy major who's like, no, let me do it. This is what you really mean. Okay. Now, sometimes the philosopher is actually right. People are confused. The things they're saying make no sense. And I mean, it isn't always politic or useful to try, but like in theory and principle, you kind of need to step in and say, wait, you people, this just makes no sense. Trust me. But on the other hand, sometimes the philosopher is just being an idiot because it actually does turn on details that philosophy as such doesn't give you access to. So when I say that philosophy is so important, I don't mean that it's so important in a way that if you have philosophy, you don't need anything else. You also need the details. So people sometimes, when there are like, you know, conflicts in universities about, you know, who gets how much funding and who gets the best building on campus and all that, they call these turf wars, right? And so people are fighting over different parts of the turf. Well, if I can just go with that metaphor a little bit, philosophy isn't like just another part of the turf. It's actually like the dirt that's under all the grass. But you need both dirt and grass. Philosophers tend to forget that you need grass. They just think, well, look, a lot of dirt. But then all you have is a muddy field, right? So you actually do need the plants. We actually do need the physicists and all those other people. But they need us. Okay. And everybody, but it's not just a question of us. They need to become more philosophical. We all do. Okay. So, I've been talking about why it's so useful to have a grip on fundamental things. Let me add another one. It helps a lot to have a good grip on philosophical principles if you want to make any kind of decent progress when you're doing theology. Now, let me just say this kind of bluntly. When you scratch a bad theologian, usually there's just bad philosopher underneath. And it happens a lot. It's a very big problem. Someone pointed out to me that nowadays, let's say, yeah, I don't know. Nowadays, if you are ordained a Catholic priest, then you will just sort of by law have done pretty much at least the equivalent of an undergraduate major in philosophy. That's not a lot, but it's something, you know? But you can become a professional theologian with a PhD in theology and be teaching at some university and not have taken one philosophy course your whole life long. I'm not saying this is a good idea. I'm just saying that it can be done. It's crazy. So if you care at all about theology and you think it's interesting, learn more philosophy,
Remember what I was saying? You can't make sense out of the Bible unless you, yeah, okay. So it's like that. Hugely important. A big problem. Another thing I want to say about studying philosophy and getting philosophical is more sort of interpersonal, almost a question of how to be a good friend or to be pastorally effective, whether by pastorally you mean something sort of technically pastoral, like you're a priest, or just kind of in an informal way in which we all sort of have to be pastoral to one another from time to time. When you become aware of fundamental principles, fundamental distinctions, and so forth, then you just get a lot better at figuring out what's happening in conversations. People are talking, you more quickly notice when two people are using the same word, but they actually mean different things, and they think they disagree, but they don't. Or sometimes people think they agree, but they actually disagree. The opposite can happen. Sometimes people are just keep switching back and forth between topics, and the whole conversation's a mess, and somebody needs to say, wait, are we talking about this, or are we talking about that? And then everything can fall into place. Sometimes when people come and they present some problem and they go, oh, well, I'm really mad at the church. It has this terrible teaching. Like, let them talk for a while. Try to figure it. Don't just refute them, right? Just tell me what you think, but and listen carefully. And if you're good at this, you start to realize this is really about something else. They're really talking about something else. And you can steer the conversation to that other thing and investigate. But this only happens if you have this kind of intellectual power that you get from thinking deeply in terms of deeper principles and distinctions and so forth. So this is not a bag of apologetics tricks. This is not like, oh, wait, you said such and such. Hold on, that's on page 39. Here's the answer to that one. Take that, Protestant. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about like this intellectual power you have to understand what people are saying and to sort it out. And sometimes that means sorting out the emotional content from the intellectual content and then dealing with each of them in the way that it needs to be dealt with. Now, it's dangerous to have this power because you can go around just trying to control everybody all the time. I mean, that's sort of related to that philosophy major thing I was talking about before. But nonetheless, it can be very useful and valuable. So what this goes towards saying is that philosophy is not just like a bunch of things that you want to learn, a bunch of like truths that you can memorize, maybe with attached little arguments. It's an intellectual power, an intellectual virtue. It's a skill. It's a thing that you can do. It's a power. It's a kind of superpower. It's a settled skill, a way of being good at a certain kind of thinking. Now, this all, thinking of this as you guys as like chapter leaders, right? I'm just trying to give you ways of thinking about what's the point of doing what we're doing. I mean, there's all kinds of good reasons and things that you can accomplish by running a TI chapter. One is that you get to like bring in speakers and then go out to maybe restaurants that are better than the ones you're used to going to. And it's kind of fun. And that's like great, you know? But insofar as you're actually trying to cultivate something intellectual, I mean, what's the slogan, right? It matters what you think. That's a great slogan, okay? That's a great slogan. But it matters what you think, not just it matters which Thomistic slogans you have memorized. So it requires a lot of thinking. So just thinking really well. Okay. So much for that. That's a lot of things in support of the idea that philosophy, as I've tried to characterize it, thinking about fundamental things, a sort of grab bag of reasons why it's useful, helpful, why it will do you and the other people around you good, and how it will benefit you in all parts of your life, all parts of your life. Now, I want to make a brief little remark about why philosophy seems so hard and maybe even impossible. And then I want to switch gears and talk about two prerequisites for becoming good at philosophy, or really anything, but since
we're talking about philosophy, I'll focus on that.
So why is it so hard? And in particular, why is it so hard that philosophers themselves don't ever seem to be any good at it? Because, you know, in chemistry, they actually like to make progress. They used to believe in phlogiston. Now they don't. They have the periodic table all worked out. It's amazing. And philosophers are still talking about the stuff that Plato and Aristotle talked about. And some people, including some philosophers, think that this basically shows that philosophy is kind of stupid. It's just like rambling, and you should stop doing it. That's what needs to be taken seriously. Well, I have two little comments. The first one is, you should expect philosophy to be this hard because of what philosophy is. So think, you've got a problem with the air conditioning system in a building, and you're some kind of a HVAC engineer. Now, how are you going to solve this problem? Well, one of the things you're going to do is you're going to think about some principles of fluid mechanics that you learned back in college. You're going to reach to a deeper, more fundamental science and then apply those principles to this thing at hand. That's what's so cool about being an engineer. You can do this. You can solve problems. Very gratifying. Now, when you're doing philosophy, you are trying anyway to get to the absolute bottom, most fundamental thing that you can. Well, if you're there, then you can't go any deeper to figure out, to appeal to even deeper principles to solve your problems, because you are at the bottom already. So you should expect that this is insanely difficult, and that there are just different, even the methods for figuring out which principles are better and worse are quite different, and they're just not the normal way the human mind operates. So that's like a philosophical explanation of why philosophy is so hard. But the other thing I want to say is this, and I think this is actually really important, and it applies not only in philosophy. It applies actually in a sort of very special way in theology, but it applies in a lot of things. Just because you don't have everything doesn't mean you have nothing. It's easy to think that if you're some sort of confused about the philosophy of friendship, then you must have no idea what friendship is, and you can't tell friends from enemies. That's probably false. You probably do have a rough and ready idea of what friendship is, and a rough and ready idea of different types of friendship. If you've read a little bit of Aristotle, you're like, oh yeah, he's right. So now, you know, now you've read it, now you understand it better. But are there some like weird little puzzles and confusing things? Sure, that's fine. So you don't have everything, but that doesn't mean you have nothing. So when you get confused philosophically, and we all do, I mean, I've been literally doing this longer than you guys have been alive, and I spend a lot of time very confused. I have come to really enjoy it. It's a kind of exhilarating feeling because I know I'm out into new territory. It's new to me anyway. But it doesn't mean I have nothing. There are a lot of things that I know. I may not be sure whether, you know, two electrons can ever be one electron or whatever. I don't even know what that means. But I know that, like, I know what a dog is, you know? Okay. So this is just another comment on the difficulty. Try not to panic and become a skeptic just because philosophy is so hard. And don't beat up on yourself if you do panic every once in a while. I mean, like, it happens. You just go take a walk or something. Okay. So now I want to completely shift gears and talk about two prerequisites to becoming philosophically stronger. This applies to pretty much all of life, but I'm talking about philosophy. I said this before. I'm a little bit worried about discussing these things because I don't want to sound like I'm being bossy or scolding. But they are important things that need to be talked about. And, well, we'll just see how it goes. In order to be good philosophically, you need to be able to focus for a long time on some very hard things. You got to put your mind on it and keep your mind on it. And then things come up and you have to like make a distinction and then take this one and put it over here and say, I'll come back to you later. I'm just thinking about this one now. And keep doing it for a long time and not be all over the place all the time. So you have to stay alert to what's relevant, to dismiss what's not relevant, to have complicated assemblages of large, complicated thoughts. It takes a lot of working memory. All of this is very, very difficult for a human being. It's very, very difficult for anyone. But in our culture, it's extra hard. It's much harder than it was when I was your age. And the reason for that is because there's an entire gigantic industry designed to prevent you from doing that. Well, maybe that's not exactly, that's not their goal. That's just their means. Their goal is to get a lot more money by advertising. So, of course, I'm talking about social media and other aspects of things on the internet, right? So these people, they're extremely skillful at this. And what they do is they capture your attention and they fragment it into lots of tiny little pieces and then sell it to advertisers. So it's a win for them when you're looking at an ad. They just sold some of your attention to someone. Now, that attention is like the most fundamental power of your soul, the intellectual power anyway, to like focus on something. And so that power of your soul, that crucial power, has just been acquired and sold. And that should bother you. I feel like 10 years ago, people were like, nah, this is not a problem. But people don't say that anymore. So I'm actually a little feeling more optimistic. But I just want to bring this up, and it's good to really reflect on it, okay? This is a big deal. And so this, but it's relevant for us because if you are sitting there trying to read a philosophy book and you just can't do it, it might be because philosophy is so difficult, but it also might in part be because your mind is in a thousand places and you're not good at thinking about anything that lasts longer than a TikTok video. And if that's the case, you got a problem. And those people out there in California, they are not going to help you solve that. They want you to have this problem. It's good news for them. So you got to cut way back on all that stuff. And this is a hard thing to do. You got to cut way back on TikTok, social media, texting. Now, you might get some benefit out of these things. But there's this fallacy that goes like this. If I get some benefit out of something, I should bring it into my life. I mean, I can imagine a circumstance where I wish I had brought a hand grenade. But I'm not going to carry hand grenades around all the time just because I might be useful. I'm going to just gamble, you know? This, like every other day of my life, is one of those days where I didn't need a hand grenade. I may lose this gamble, but I feel safe. So you can't fall for that fallacy, and you have to think very long and hard about all of these trade-offs. The content of this media is often the least important part of it. I mean, the content can be incredibly destructive. I don't mean to deny that. But even if the content is fairly innocent, just the way you're going whoop, 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 whoop all the time, that itself is highly significant. So, think, like, which of the things where the trade-off is worth it and which of the things maybe you can't actually do without text messaging? Maybe that's true for at least most of the time. But I find it very implausible that most people, their lives just won't work if they don't have TikTok. It seems to me extremely implausible. So, and if they aren't worth the trade-off, then the fact that there's sometimes some good comes out of it, you should just ditch it. Now, let me say something. This is very important. I'm not trying to shame you young people. I'm really not. And there's two reasons. First of all, people my age are often just as addicted and screwed up as you guys are. Okay? That's totally true. But there's another reason which is even more important and more fundamental. It's people my age who invented this stuff and foisted it on the world. Okay? So, like, I remember, so I'm 60 years old. I'm a sort of an old Gen Xer. And I remember looking, you know, just thinking about like a baby boomer politicians and all these people and saying, what happened to the Gen Xers? Like, what did we ever do? Like, when have we been a president? Like, the first president, the first Gen Xer president would have been Kamala Harris, except she lost. Okay. So, like, what have we been doing? And the answer is we've been screwing up the world with the internet. Okay, so that's the answer. We've had a very, very influential generation. Great. So I'm just trying to say, I'm not trying to shame young people. That's not the point at all. All right. Now, let me add something here. Going minimal on these devices, as we call them, technology, as we call them. I mean, a toothbrush is technology. A plow is technology. But for some reason nowadays, when we say technology, we just mean computers. Anyway, you know, as if, isn't that weird? So anyway, going minimal can be really hard to do all on your own. Because if you do it and no one else does it, then you just have less contact with other people, but you don't really see the upside because everyone else is looking at their phones and you're just sort of sitting there. So, I mean, maybe it's beneficial because you can at least think or something like that. But what I'm trying to say is, if this is attractive to you to try to cut down on this stuff, find other people who feel the same way and find ways to do it together. Maybe there's one day a week or one morning a week when you just turn off the phones and don't use them and just do things in real life together. You know, people now have parties where they like park their phones at the door and stuff like that. These things are important because this is called a network effect or something. Maybe I'm wrong about that term. But anyway, it's the kind of thing where if one person does it, there's not much benefit. But if 50 people do it, there's a lot of benefit. So find those other people. There's a book that I'll recommend about this called Digital Minimalism. It's by a guy who's named Cal Newport, who I think is a good writer on a lot of topics. And he has a website, and I don't know, does he sleep? I don't really get it, you know. But anyway, he's written very well on this topic, I think. Okay, so that's my first little prerequisite, is laying off the screen stuff. The second precursor or prerequisite is that you have to do the work yourself. And what I mean can best be put out by talking, well, okay, sorry. Let me jump ahead so you know where I'm going. I'm talking about artificial intelligence now. Okay. So going to college, for example, it's like buying a gym membership. Now, if you buy a gym membership, buying a gym membership doesn't make you thin. It doesn't make you strong. It doesn't increase your cardiovascular capacity. Those things happen by like lifting weights, running and running and running, and things like this. Okay, paying for the gym membership does not in and of itself benefit your physical fitness at all. What it does is it gives you an opportunity to do a lot of difficult and unpleasant things. If you don't then seize that opportunity, you're just making a donation to the gym company. I know some people who teach at a university different from mine, who their name for the students who like come to college but they never do any work is donors. That's really dark, isn't it? It's funny too. You have to go to the gym, metaphorically speaking. You have to do the actual work. So, well, literally speaking, you have to go to the gym. You don't get good at philosophy by enrolling in a philosophy class. You get good at philosophy by doing philosophy, by reading, by listening to lectures, by thinking, by writing papers. Now, this has always been true, and it's always been a temptation for students. Students are, I don't know who said this, the worst consumers in the world. They're always willing to pay more and more and get less and less. But it's reached new heights now because of artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence is like going to the gym and bringing a forklift. So you go over to the machine and you just push the button and the weights are going up and down and you're like, right? But the fact is, you're still the skinny person you were. All right. So if you use artificial intelligence, ChatGPT or whatever, to write your papers, to write your emails, to summarize your readings, then your mind is staying weak, flabby, scrawny, pick your own favorite shaming word. And you are becoming the kind of person who can be replaced by artificial intelligence. You've got nothing. So then they're like, yeah, we can do this with AI. And they'll be right. So just as you want to be healthy and strong and fit, you should also want to be smart and knowledgeable, really good at spotting BS and all the rest of that stuff. And that means not that you have a device in your pocket that can do those things, but that you can do those things. You can do those things. Just like you don't want to only have a car, you also actually want to be able to walk. So your professors are your personal trainers. And the TI speakers that you bring in, they are personal trainers. And you want to get them to make you sweat. And this is just a problem that everybody has to face right now. But you guys are at this privileged time in your life where you're in this institutional setup, which is designed to make you work hard. And if you do it, you will really benefit from it. And if you fall prey to the temptation to not do it, then you'll pass up on the benefit. And among many other things, you won't be good at philosophy. You may have a little app called Aquinas GPT. And you can ask it any question you want. You know, do dogs have souls? Yes. Do dogs have immortal souls and go to heaven? No. See, oh, great, I'm good at philosophy, right? But no, you're not. Okay. So I'm almost done. To draw all this together, to be a smart and effective person in any realm of life, it always helps to be philosophical. Not everyone can be a professional philosopher. Thank goodness. But everyone can be at least somewhat philosophical. And if you become at least somewhat philosophical, it will benefit you. You will be just good at everything else that you do. And there will be times when you have free time to be a reflective, deep person who can think about things. And that's a very satisfying way to live. And you'll be kind of oriented in the world, and you'll know what's going on. But you can't be that way if you can't focus on anything in the first place. And you can't focus on anything if your brain is total flab because you haven't used it in 10 years because you let computers do everything for you. So you gotta spend more time thinking, doing the hard work of thinking by yourself, reading, talking to other people. Think the hard way. It's the only way. All right, well, that's all. I'm going to stop now. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.